This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Stocks responding to positive news about a possible trade deal despite some setbacks in economic news this week. Housing starts are weakening. The Conference Board's leading economic index turns negative, and a real negative report coming out from the Philly Fed, but everybody was positive as stocks rally on this Friday. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in the first hour will be Basil Chapman. He says stocks are probably subject to a short-term pullback before heading higher. He said if you want to watch things, take a look at the semis and the transports. If they head higher, well, that's a clue. The markets could be heading higher. And also later on in the program, John Ng from Maison Placement will be joining us. He's saying gold is in a short-term pullback, but he also expects gold to head higher as well. And, of course, Chris Sheridan will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in Hour 2, the big picture. With a slowdown in housing, falling auto sales, contractions in Europe, and the Conference Board's leading economic indicators going negative, you'd think there would be real caution from public officials and economists. On this edition of The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss these realities and the seeming conspiracy of silence surrounding some of these concerning indicators. What should investors be doing now? What should you do with bonds? Should you focus on value over growth? Those questions answered and more on this edition of The Big Picture.
This week, the stock market made another week of gains. The S&P 500 closing at 2792, the Dow at 26,031, and the NASDAQ at 7527. Turns out that with the big rally that we've seen now since the market bottom late last year, 2019 has started off to be a year for the history books. CNBC reporting that just after the worst December since the Great Depression, we've now seen one of the biggest rallies since 1964. And CNBC notes that both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the NASDAQ have yet to register a weekly decline so far this year. And this would mark the first time since 1964 that the Dow has rallied in each of the first 9 weeks of the year and the first time in history that has happened for the NASDAQ. This week, most of the optimism was based on more and more headlines talking about a trade deal going through. The Wall Street Journal just reporting that President Trump says he's looking at a possible meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping next month to finish up a trade deal. They go on to report that the two sides also agreed to extend high-level negotiations in Washington for 2 more days. They're expressing optimism for a resolution, and Mr. Trump said he is prepared to extend his March 1st deadlines for closing a deal, and that would prevent 10% tariffs on $20 billion in Chinese imports from jumping to 25% on March 2nd. So a lot of headlines, particularly coming out late on Thursday and on Friday, that helped lead the market to jump to a positive close for this week. So investors are definitely banking on a trade deal happening, more progress on that front. If we don't see that happen, then we'll have to see whether or not a lot of this optimism is baked into the stock market behavior or not. In other news, Kraft Heinz saw a huge tumble and plummeted as much as 27% this week on missed earnings expectations, slashing its dividend and also announcing that it had received a subpoena from the SEC. Bloomberg reported that when Kraft Heinz merged in 2015, analysts wondered where the growth would come with a suite of aging brands, including Jell-O and Kool-Aid. Changing consumer tastes and shopping habits have decimated sales at the largest food companies in the U.S. as shoppers gravitate to more natural and organic options rather than prepackaged and sugar-laden products. Kraft Heinz is the third largest food and beverage company in North America and the fifth largest in the world. So it's a behemoth, and it saw a record decline this week. That is also putting some pressure on Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway as well, which is a holder. We also saw a slew of data points this week confirming an ongoing slowdown in the global economy. South Korea's chip exports fell nearly 30% during the first 20 days of February, with exports to China falling 13.6%. Briefing notes, Japan's February flash manufacturing PMI fell to contraction under 50 at 48.5. Germany's manufacturing numbers also fell to 47.6, again under 50s, showing contraction. And the Eurozone February flash manufacturing numbers also fell under 50. Briefing says that South Korea, Japan, and Germany are among the world's top exporters. Data released today pointed to a continued deceleration in activity, which implies slower economic growth. Because of all this, central banks are increasingly taking a more dovish tone. The FOMC minutes that were released this week regarding their January meeting basically noted that the Fed is going to be patient in raising rates and is likely to stop reducing the assets on its balance sheet later this year. The one caveat to that is they said that they are willing to change their language if, and this is a big if the stock market is going to continue to rally, if the economic data points improve, and if inflation, of course, ticks up from here. So if we do see that, then they are willing to change their stance. But at this point, it looks like the central banks are going to remain on the easing side, especially if we continue to see more weak data points on the manufacturing side, whether or not that's the US or the global economy. On a positive note, we did see in this shortened week, Monday being off because of President's Day, but we did see a positive earnings report from Walmart, Walmart being a major bellwether for consumer behavior, given how many people shop at Walmart. They saw a strong fourth quarter highlighted by healthy same-store sales growth. This helped to temper concerns about a slowdown in consumer spending here in the U.S. that were fueled by the lousy retail sales report for December that came out last week. Briefing goes on to note that the good showing from Walmart is creating some breathing room around the idea that the December retail sales weakness was aberrant and most likely not repeated in January when the stock market was rallying and the employment data was supportive. One last positive data point to note was the February home builder index actually surprised to the upside with a print of 62. They attributed the improvement to the ongoing reduction in mortgage rates in recent weeks, coupled with the continued strength in the job market. And they also go on to say that in the aftermath of the fall slowdown, many builders are reporting positive expectations for the spring selling season. There is a caveat with that, however, and they say affordability remains a critical issue. Rising costs stemming from excessive regulations, a dearth of buildable lots, a persistent labor shortage, and tariffs on lumber and other key building materials continue to make it increasingly difficult to produce housing at affordable price point. So that is the wrap up for this week. Be sure to hear The Big Picture, where Jim and Chris Prytower will also provide more color on the economic data points and a number of the other forces that are going to be weighing on the markets, likely in the weeks and months ahead.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
So that's disruption, right? A big company or a few big companies lose a gigantic amount of market share. We're not talking about 1 or 2 percentage points. We're talking about a gigantic market share. And so as you point out, in the past 25 years, there's been 3 waves of digital disruption. Digital, I mean, mostly internet. Right.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
The stock market is having another good week, although the day we're doing this interview, we have a little bit of a downdraft, but so far, as tough as it was for the fourth quarter, at least for the first month of this year, And this month, it's looking pretty good for the markets. Will this trend stay in place, or are there ominous signs ahead of us? Joining us on the program from Opening Call and head of Tiger Technicians Hour is Basil Chapman. Basil, I want to go back to last time we had you on the show, which was in September, and you were warning about some of the FANG stocks being overbought, also VIX volatility. I wonder if we could just review a couple of the things that you were seeing back then, and then let's move forward to where we are right now.
Sure. So, Jim, what I was looking at is I'd mentioned that it was a very good opportunity to start raising cash. And one of the reasons was that it looked to me, technically, that the FANG stocks, that's Facebook, Apple, you've got Netflix, you've got Google, and I'm skipping Amazon, of course. So those were the stocks that had a spectacular couple of years, and they just looked as if my monthly charts, I like to go from time sequences, so that if the monthly charts start to look like they're getting toppy, then you can only get the actual turn from the daily. Then the weekly will confirm that. And then once the weekly confirms a sell mode in my work, that says that the monthly chart will start to be impacted. And what I was looking at was there was a chance that those FANG stocks could take a timeout that wasn't just 6 weeks. It could be quite a few months. So that was number one. Number two is I've been discussing the volatility index, and it looked to me like the volatility index was something that we should watch. And I gave certain numbers, parameters that I always look for. It's exactly the same thing that we're going to be looking at right now. The volatility index in this case has gone from the 13-14 area. If it starts to go into the 15s and 16s, this is this is a measure of fear. And if it starts to rally and you get a commensurate decline in the market, that would be a heads up to say, hey, we're starting some kind of a consolidation. Once it gets into the 20s, that's really not good. You start to see triple digit Dow daily closes to the downside. And so that's what I gave as a warning. I'd also mentioned the dollar had a fantastic run. I like the dollar for subscribers. We've been long since April, and I still like the dollar. And it seemed to me that not institutions, but countries were actually buying the dollar. I didn't know how to measure it. It just seemed to me that there was big money coming into the dollar because it held well, even when gold was starting to rally. And even now that gold has had quite a bit of a breakout, the dollar is still holding pretty well. And in fact, on a very short-term basis, I think gold is about to pull back, and we'll see how that impacts the dollar. So we're also looking at the semiconductors, which I had said for me is like a bellwether in a certain way, because the semiconductor, they're in everything. And the semiconductor made a top. The SMH has made a top at 114 back in March of 2018 and never followed through. It just didn't make a new high when the Dow and the S&P were making new highs in October. The semiconductors were pulling back. Well, they went from 114 down to 80. They've actually had a spectacular 27% rally here, something that we've got to keep our eyes on for the very short term. The other was that the transportation index was working with the Dow at the time, but I said we've got to watch that because if the transportation index starts to fail, that'll be a heads up that we could have a sell. And the other thing that I was talking about was that interest rates were kind of steady. They've been in the same range for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So that wasn't an issue for me, but we were watching the financials. And then I had also mentioned that what I had liked, and these were areas that I still like, the cybersecurity hack is the ETF, the broker dealers, the IAI, medical cannabis, that's the MJ ETF, and the financials, the XLF. Those were the areas that I'd be looking at if there was a sharp sell-off that should rebound quite strongly and should perform quite well in 2019.
Basil, did it surprise you when we take a look, just to go back last year, where the markets pulled back very swiftly, gave back all the gains in February, the safety trade, things like gold and interest rates did not do well. And then when the markets began to fall off the cliff in October, initially that didn't happen. But as we got into, let's say, the end of November and December, gold started to take off and interest rates started to fall. Did that surprise you or take you by surprise?
The interest rate part of it, I had mentioned, I'd shown a chart, my monthly, I have a particular tech methodology. And when there's the four higher peaks from a low of an identifiable low, when you get to that, I label them alphabetically, peak A, then sequentially B, then the next highest peak is C, and then D. other things can happen at D. And that's where we got to in the monthly chart, even though on the 10-year, the TNX actually broke a very long-term downtrend. It did go to that D and it started to pull back. That said to me that rates should be pulling back. And the one difference is that for quite some time now, you'll probably remember in the old days when the stock market was very, we call it volatility. That's just another name for going down. So when the market was going down, very often we would see money migrate from the insecurity of the securities of equities and go into the so-called safety of bonds. It hasn't been happening quite that way for a while. And my suspicion is that the Fed is trying to get some form of inflation here. And we cannot rule out that yields could, in fact, go high. And this is the big test because the TLT, as we're talking, the market is down 90 points, the Dow is, and the TLT is down over one. And it says to me something else is going on in the TLT. And what I've been talking about on my show, on my Tiger Technician's Hour, is for some time, is I think that we've got to separate a bunch of things. Gold is both a fear factor and is partly a kind of an inflationary factor. The dollar, to me, is a measure of the world's respect for the United States economy. And I try to separate those. For most of the time, you will get counterpoint, like Bach has counterpoint, where one melody goes up and the other melody goes down. So you see the same mirror image very often in gold. When gold goes up, the dollar goes down. It hasn't been quite that way for a while. So I think we're looking at a way of looking at the market now that is a little bit untraditional. I think we're starting to go into an era that, at least for the next 18 months, at least for this part of the final stage of this particular president's four-year term, I think we're looking at something different. And when you look at it as objectively as possible, the president doesn't have anything. He's claimed the stock market as his. And I think he's got to latch onto that. That's got to be his bailiwick, because he's not going to get legislation through. I mean, there's a lot of conflict and conflagration going on. I think that's what he's got. And I think for investors, you've got to keep that in mind, that this market has a base attached to it. And I think that's very important.
So given these, I guess, irregular things that you're starting to see, as you look forward here, a couple of positive things have happened. We may get a trade deal, although that has not been decided yet. The Fed has kind of done a 180, Basil, from where they were talking in September, October, and December. If you were to look at this market going forward, do you think we remain in a trading range because a lot of the stocks are above their 200-day moving average now, or do you think we launch higher and hit a new high?
So we'll be talking time sequences. In the very short term, I think that in many ways, we're overbought. It's really, any way you look at a chart, the technicals, the MACD, and I use the moving average convergence divergence, and in the charts that I've sent you, you'll see that all the daily charts, the MACD is still very strong, and the stochastic is over 80%. It's actually over 90% in most cases. So it's going to take a while for the prices to come down to impact the daily charts negatively on a purely technical level. But I think what I'm looking at now is either we get a really a series of very sharp sell-offs so that you get your 400-500 points down to impact the Dow technically, or there's just a series of slightly lower highs and lower lows, and it takes a couple of weeks before we actually feel that impact, or we see the impact technically. So I'm looking at this and I'm saying, at least for now, I think the old 26,000 level on the Dow, I'm using the Dow for the moment, as being kind of a barrier. 25,900 should be a barrier. Maybe you pop once over 26,000, but I would not be surprised if now we start to see that it's more and more difficult for stocks to break to the upside. Individual stocks might, but I'm talking about in fact, on my show just an hour or so ago, I was going through the Investor's Business Daily top 10, and almost every one of them has exactly this picture that I'm looking at. It's the same as the Dow. All the technicals are good, but they're just starting to bump into resistance. So on the shorter term, my short term might be other people's long term, you never know. But I'm saying in a period of going into, say, mid-March, if the Dow starts to trade underneath the 25,500 level on the shorter term and then takes out 25,300, I think then we're looking at a consolidation that's going to take place. But there are so many, the speed that we made a type of V-shaped bottom that we saw back in 2009. That usually doesn't happen. You know the markets. Usually you make a low. I call it like an earthquake, and then you get your aftershock, the internal low, and then the residual low makes this U-shaped pattern. I'm sorry, this arch-shaped pattern. There's a retest, and then you start the big move. We haven't even had a retest. So this is just straight up. So I think so many people have missed getting into the market. It's going there as well. I think it gives you a floor. So the 200-period moving average at 24,800, I think that's going to be an area where you start to see very strong support if the Dow does have a pullback over the next few weeks. And at the same time, I believe that the high of 26,951 will be taken out this year.
So given this, and also I wonder if you might spend a few moments, we're in the third year of a presidential cycle. I know you look at time sequences. How does this normally play out, number one? And number two, how do you think it will play out given this presidential cycle? And not to mention all the stimulus that we've seen, especially fiscal stimulus coming from the government.
Let me answer that instead of just giving you time sequences and numbers, if I can just talk about what I've been discussing for quite some time. It's called the coda phase. And the coda phase, if you know, in music, say in Beethoven, you get your third, the final movement, and then right at the end, you'll get a wrap-up of all the different ideas, except that with Beethoven, instead of doing the normal tiddle-little-dum-bum-bum, he goes tiddle-little-dum, and then he goes off into another area. And you keep waiting for this coda to finish, and it takes forever. And then before you even know it, finally it just goes tiddle-little-dum, bum-bum, and it's finished. So this is what I'm looking at to try to put the musical context into real-term context. This is the phase, if you think about it, you try to name for yourself the last gathering you went to with just folksy people. This is not your business. I'm just talking about regular people off the street, wherever it was. And you tell me, did anybody mention a stock that they bought that had tripled or quadrupled? Did anybody give you a tip? Did anybody even talk about the stock market? This has been the most hated, vilified, mega bull market that I can ever recall, and I've been in the market a long, long time. So I don't see how we can make a top without everybody talking about the stock market. It might be a sector. It might be the marijuana sector. It might be Bitcoin. Who knows what it'll be? But they'll be talking about the stock market everywhere. And since we've got the internet, it'll be international. So I don't see us even close to that at this particular point. In fact, this is the absolute antithesis. The move that we had down in December, especially that December the 26th, 400 and something point extra decline when you thought you were just about to make a bottom and then it just plows to the low. I think that just shook people up. It's going to take a long time for them to get back in. So I think we've got time on our side. So my thinking here is 2020 is probably the year that we've got to be really careful for this kind of, I don't know if it's a climax, a major climax in the market, but I think that we're going to have a huge rally at some point. Right now, we might see a rotational correction with some of the leading stocks that led on the way up. That might include a Boeing, I'm not sure, but we will see them start to pull back. And while they're pulling back, some of the weaker sectors, and when I say weaker, I would like to see something like the broker-dealers, the IAI. I think if you look at the IAI trading right now at 61, coming off the low of 51, so it's up 10 points, but it came down from 70 back in March of last year. If that IAI index has people ready joining, coming into the broker-dealers and saying we want to open accounts or whatever, if that starts to trade in the 63 to 65, I'd say pretty much the 65 area within the next 3 months, I think that's going to be a tip-off to say that finally the public is coming in and we're really moving higher. So that's kind of my overview that I'm looking at in terms of just on a socio-economic, political, there's a lot going on here level.
And, you know, I'd like to bring this up. I've asked several of the technicians, and you kind of briefly mentioned some of this V-shaped bounce that we got. How much, in your opinion, does algo trading alter these cycles in terms of their intensity, whether it's the speed on the downside or actually the speed on the upside, as we've seen in January?
So you remember back in when we had program trading, that was we've always had something that is exacerbating a move in the market. And it could even be options. If you go back to options from when Options Friday was just a really important period, now we have a lot more important periods. But you would get a move in the market that accelerated either down or up when at a moment you never even expected. And that's usually because we call them the big guys got in because they saw the market going down or going up. So I, because of the numbers that we're talking about and the number of trades, I mean, sometimes there are millions of trades made in a split second. I don't think it's going to change. A chart is a chart. I'm looking at a chart. I don't know whether there's program trading on the chart. The chart seems to match charts that I go back to 1929. I could have, in fact, you asked the question, I should have given you a chart of 1929 and a chart of of right now and say, you tell me which chart is 1920 and which chart is 2019. A chart is a chart. So the answer is, from my perspective, it doesn't really change anything. From a micro perspective, you are seeing people utilizing technology to its absolute, to a degree that we've never seen historically. But I don't think it changes the bigger picture.
And outside the bigger picture, I guess if there was anything that would alter your views, if there was something to crop up that could change where you see things heading, what would that be, in your opinion?
I'm not sure that I'd change anything. When we talk about political conflagration, hey, it's just been going on forever. I don't see any difference at this particular point. No, I like what we're doing right now. I think the market is learning how to ignore certain factors and look at others. What I would like to see is some kind of a pullback that gives a really good buying opportunity for those people who missed getting in earlier. And that to me would be the perfect scenario.
All right. So given where you see things heading, what would you be telling investors to do right now?
Have patience. If you miss some of the moves, if you've got stocks that you've loved, I mean, I have stocks that I loved and I didn't get into them because you can only get into so many. But there are stocks that are under the radar. I've often mentioned something like waste management. I mean, is that affected by anything? No, they always have their waste management. They're just certain stocks. Cybersecurity, I still like that. I think that the whole medical marijuana maybe needs a bit of a pullback now. I think that's a sector that should keep having a flurry of activity. Just have patience and identify what you really like. Have two prices. One is a price that looks like you've got a 20 to 30% pullback. That's where you'd like to have it. And then some crazy price lower than that that you might not get. But maybe if you do get it, that's a really great entry point. But I don't think I would be chasing right now. Or if you've missed something, the other thing is maybe you want to just nibble on it now, saying this is really not the price I want, but I just want to get a feel for it. I've missed the big move. I just want to nibble, but my real price, and then name a price maybe 15%, 12% lower that you would like to get in. Because I think that the V-shaped pattern that we've made suggests very strongly that it's going to take a lot of bad news, really bad news, to get back to even halfway of the move that we had from the December 26 low.
All right. Well, listen, Basil, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, there's two ways our listeners can follow you. Why don't you tell them how they could do so?
So my newsletter is called The Opening Call. It's available at tfnn.com. And I'm also the host noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called The Tiger Technician's Hour on tfnn.com. It's Monday through Friday on market days. And I take calls, I try to answer questions, and I go through the analysis every single day. And it's live and it's on TV. You can see the charts. It's quite exciting.
Basil, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best. And we hope to talk to you once again.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate that.
Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The high we struck back in 2018, that we count that as the third wave of the five-wave structure off the 2009 lows. That means this correction has been a fourth wave, which leaves a fifth wave rally yet to come. And the potential starting to really develop that could very well be one of those blow-off type of rallies that that really push sentiment to an absolute extreme.
One of the best performing investments in the last couple months has been the price of gold. It's always had difficulty over the last 3 or 4 years, but it looks like it's finally breaking out. Joining me on the program is John Eng from Maison Placement. John, what is driving the price of gold here? Is it the dollar? Is it international tension? Is it what's going on in the markets? I mean, we had that sell-off towards the end of the year, but, you know, we have interest rates coming down and we have the market doing well, but gold's doing well as well.
Well, I think what's helping gold is all the above. What we saw was a strong dollar and gold's moved up since October. In fact, it's almost up 29% measured by the GDX itself. The expectations, of course, for gold has been it will break out, it will break out. And I think finally the 1300 to 1325 was a resistance area. Took a little bit of time, but we have a decisive breakout definitely this week. My expectation is there's some a little resistance at 1375, Jim. But after that, we should start seeing $100, $200 moves in, at the same time as it fills a gap. Fundamentally, there's no question that the trade war has created a lot of uncertainty. But meanwhile, I think where you live, the deficits are just getting larger and larger. You have budgetary deficits of $1 trillion on top of $22 trillion of debt, and this comes at a time when the America will need the financing. We know that spending has increased something like about 18%, and the reality is that that trade gap can't be closed by just increased taxes. There has to be a desire to cut back spending, and that's not in the offing. So then that puts the pressure, of course, as we know, on the Fed yet again, and that is one of the reasons why I think it spurred gold was that after four rate hikes, we saw Fed Chairman Powell do a dramatic U-turn and realizing, of course, that it hit the stock market on the downside and thus turning to a dovish stance and the unlikelihood in this uncertainty of raising rates. That was good fodder for higher prices for gold. But one of the most telling things have been, and this is what I think a lot of investors should pay heed, is that one of the biggest insiders for gold are the central banks. And the central banks have been buying gold. In fact, last year, the purchases, according to the World Gold Council, went up something like 74%. That's at a 50-year high. Something like 651 tons of gold. Now, we know the Russians were a big buyer. In fact, I think Russia bought almost a third of world supplies last year. China was a big buyer. They've been buying for the last 2 months for the first time in 2 years. But we also have Japan as a big buyer. So what I say is the biggest insiders, the central banks, if they see something as amok. They have been buying gold as a hedge, as a store of value. And I think that they realize that the U.S. dollar will go lower, and particularly with Powell standing back, and with the uncertainty of geopolitical environment, the central banks have been buying gold. And then, of course, you have investors. You look at the gold miners. The gold miners themselves, they're the second insiders, so to speak. They have been buying each other. So that, to me, creates a very powerful environment.
So, John, when you take a look at, we have a number of things. You talked about what's going on with the dollar, our trade deficits, our budget deficits. In fact, our twin deficits have never been as large. But what is to keep this up and keep it going further? Because you take a look at last year, this was going on. Gold started out the year with stock assets rising, and then we had the downturn in February. And it wasn't until late in the year that gold took off, even though these other things were occurring at the same time. So what's driving it now?
Well, I think that if we look at what China was in the market buying gold,
when you looked at, again, I say the central banks, they physically have been buying gold. The ETFs have been buying gold in the month of December. And those are two very big buyers. You have the uncertainty, of course, in Europe, everything from the Brexit to France to now Germany. Are they going to be in a recession? There's the realization that the investing environment is pretty hostile, notwithstanding the fact that we've had a rally in the last month in stock prices.
Well, we know, John, all good things eventually come to an end, and this bull market has been going on for almost 10 years, so we're probably in the latter stages. What about the impact of the Federal Reserve? It's been raising interest rates up until recently, where they sort of did a 180 in January. Do you think that's helping out gold as well?
Well, there's no question that the fear of higher interest rates took some of the steam out of the gold in the last couple of years. But if we do not have rate increases, that U.S. dollar has been propped up by the fear of higher interest rates. And as I say, the realization that, in fact, there's a lot of red ink, the prognosis for the U.S. dollar is much lower. And of course, these trade wars really don't help it. You have a dramatic drop off in money capital flows going into the United States. And the realization, of course, is that if China does not buy treasuries, in fact, they've been dumping treasuries. They dumped about $500 billion of treasuries. The Russians, of course, they dumped all their treasuries. If countries do not prop up buy these treasuries, they're only leaves yourselves or the Fed. And the Fed's, of course, balance sheet is choking on $4 trillion of mostly of treasuries, too. So the realization is that the financial house of the United States is not in order, and that could dictate a much lower dollar, and of course, that means higher gold prices.
Well, you know, if we look right now, we've had stock prices rising since the beginning of the year. We've had falling bond yields and rising gold prices. All of this is occurring simultaneously. Have you ever seen something like this occur before, where you had risk assets such as stocks going up, but at the same time, what is considered the safety trade, which would be treasuries and the price of gold, they're also rallying at the same time?
In the late 70s, Jim, we had rising interest rates and we had a rising gold price. It was a sort of a tug of war. And we must remember, historically, for many years, even before gold was a reserve currency, gold was a canary in the coal mine. And so my expectation is that, yes, stock prices have rallied, part of it is tech stocks, but it's very narrowly based. If you look at the broader markets, you have still yet to break above the 200-day moving average. So technically, my sense is that the stock market itself is vulnerable, but the gold prices are sort of a lead indicator of trouble ahead in 2019.
So, John, as you take a look at these factors that would be driving the price of gold, I want to talk about something you were alluding to earlier with the big companies, gold companies, buying other gold companies, because there just simply isn't any major gold discoveries that have been made. I mean, Newmont used to be a much bigger gold producer, as well as Barrick. So what's going on in the industry? In other words, if there's a demand for gold, whether it's coming from ETFs, it's coming from China or India, where's the gold going to come from?
Well, that's the dilemma. In fact, the World Gold Council recently came up, world demand was increased 4% last year. Meanwhile, the supplies of gold have been declining. We only have to look at these gold miners. When gold was trading under $1,200, it was very difficult for the gold miners to make money. You recall that only Barrick had the all-in cost below $1,000. A lot of gold miners in the last few quarters have had difficulty showing a better performance. But some of the gold mines have free cash flow. Barrick itself, which had at one time a lot of debt, now generates free cash flow. Newmont generates a big free cash flow. So I think that the $1,300 gold price
plus is very profitable for the gold mining industry. And so I think therein lies one of the reasons for the mergers and acquisitions. In Newmont's case, they were looking at a flat production profile. What they need is reserves in the ground. And if you work out the numbers, even though they paid a 17% premium for Goldcorp, is that the reserves in the ground, they picked up those ounces. And that was very telling to me. Now, they're going to have to do some major surgery on Goldcorp because Goldcorp has been a non-performer because they haven't been generating free cash flow. But when you look at Barrick, for example, Barrick rationale for taking over Randgold was the opportunity to pick up excellent management, and particularly in Mark Bristow. And the second is that they were able to diversify and get some pretty low-cost mines. So the rationale there for the gold miners, I believe, is that they're looking ahead. Prices are very attractive for them today. And so the cheapest ounces, I guess, are on Wall Street or Bay Street.
For the big guys, I guess the only way you're going to replace your reserves is go out and buy somebody else. John, I want to talk about what's going on in the exploration side of the business. Now, in the past decade, it was the small juniors that went out and made the discoveries. And of course, if it was sizable and profitable, they got taken out. But it's been a very difficult time for a lot of the juniors to raise capital. I wonder if you'd just kind of update us. What's going on the exploration front? Because in the past, that's where the gold was discovered.
Well, Jim, that's a very good question. I think in a couple of weeks, we have the PDAC, which is the Prospectors Convention here in Toronto. And it's expected there will be 25, 30,000 people in attendance. However, I note that there are fewer companies, but more and more countries that are coming here, telling me that even not only the juniors are looking for money, but the countries themselves are trying to portray a much improved and investing climate. The reality is that the juniors, we've been lacking a exploration success, a drill bit success. We've had the odd one in BC, the odd one in Australia, but really we haven't had a major discovery. So who has been financing a lot of these juniors are, in fact, the gold miners themselves. Barrick did a deal in Latin America with Reunion to give them an opening and an opportunity to expand. Agnico Eagle has financed probably a dozen juniors. So I think the gold miners themselves realize that rather than spend big dollars on exploration, they're taking a rifle shot approach, and hopefully the juniors with leaner management can explore and have success. So this is a phenomenon, or this is something that we've not seen for a long time, where the mining industry finances itself. But it also tells you how the mining industry is faced with a big dilemma of replacing the reserves, because they're what they're doing every year, they're mining. And of course, they're not being able to replace the reserves in the ground. So therein lies Newmont's or others' M&A activity. So my expectation is that some of these juniors that are in a new area, grassroots area, I think we've talked about Orania, which we helped finance a year ago. They will have two drill machines on the property, and they have something like 200,000 hectares. And Keith Barron has been quite aggressive in doing the groundwork and the geochemical work, and they've got multiple targets. So there's an area where if they discover anything, the majors will be there already. Newcrest is in Ecuador through an investment in SolGold. So you're finding these big majors are taking a peek at some of these smaller companies, and if there is a success, they'll be there to finance them.
Now, John, does that limit the upside? Let's say I'm a junior, I've got a good prospect, and I'm drilling it, and it looks like the results are going to be good. If a major finances me, they already have a good foothold in my company. Doesn't that preclude, let's say, other companies coming in and bidding?
That's a very good point. In Saugel's case, they managed to secure a number of 10%ers. They have found a porphyry. Porphyry deposits are really very capital intensive, and thus they have to drill. Thus they keep on this treadmill of raising money. Thus they're looking at these majors and hoping that they can keep two gorillas in the cage at the same time. My expectation, though, is that some of the smarter managements, they have been raising money carefully, and it's results oriented. And if in Orania's case, should they be success, they are going to do a scout drilling program, which will require initially about 7-8 holes. If they get some joy, then I think that they have enough funds. They're just doing a rights issue, I might add, to follow up on that. So it all depends on management, but it does show the desperation of some of the juniors that will cozy up to a major hoping to get some help. But a lot of the recent deals I've seen is that the investment of the majors are really, they have to vote with management. It's only until they spend a fair amount of dollars do they increase the stake. But the key is success with the drill bit, and that's what we need.
I want to turn to another precious metal, silver. It's gone up, but it hasn't been doing, John, as well as gold has. And usually, if you want a sign of a bull market, you want both of them to do well. I would have thought, at least from the industrial side, silver would be doing well, especially when you take a look at the amount of its use in things like solar panels and other aspects as electronics, because we're using a lot more silver.
That's a very good point. But we must remember, last year, silver was outperforming gold. And so it's only in the last few months has gold outperforming silver. So my expectation is that there's always this lead lag, and only towards the end of the cycle do you get them both as investors parade in. Silver is, as we all know, is an industrial commodity, and the mining industry itself has been fairly constrained in producing, as a byproduct, zinc, lead, for example. A lot of the miners have not increased production, and thus that's putting a limit on the silver coming to the market. But investor demand was pretty strong last year because gold was in a funk. Gold was going nowhere. And so we had a number of silver companies did much better. And now I've noticed that it's gold's turn. I think that sometime this summer we should see a pickup in silver.
Both of them going up is probably something we haven't seen in quite some time. John, given where the price of gold is right now, and given where the price of silver is and the equities, as an investor, what would you be doing? Would you be buying the metal first and maybe, I don't know, buy an ETF like GLD or SLV? How would you play this market?
Well, I always believe, Jim, that everybody should have some bullion. It's not necessary to look at, but it's portable, it does well, and it's just something that's very tangible. The ETFs are very attractive, thus the popularity. And there's no question that when gold picks up, having 5 to 10% of your assets in gold and ETFs are very attractive. Of interest is that the gold shares, while it's almost like a game of musical chairs, there are fewer and fewer gold miners. The gold miners, however, offer leverage. And I have found the leverage is sometimes 2.5 to 3 times that of just straight bullion. So we can't just look back at the last 4 or 5 years. We should look back a longer period. And gold shares themselves are the ultimate leverage. And if you can find a producer that can make money at $1,100 an ounce, they'll make a lot of money at $1,700-$1,800 an ounce, and you will get that leverage and that growth. So it's a little bit of everything is the best thing to have.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how could they do so, please?
Go to our website, maisonplacement.com, is probably the best way for a non-institution to follow us.
All right, John. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the program, and come back and talk to us again.
Good talking to you, Jim.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
And coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, with a slowdown in housing, falling auto sales, contractions in Europe, and the Conference Board's leading economic indicators going negative, you'd think there would be real caution from public officials and economists. On this edition of The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discussed these realities and the seeming conspiracy of silence surrounding some of these concerning indicators. What should investors be doing now? What should you do with bonds? Should you focus on value over growth? Those questions answered and more on this edition of The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.